This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Tonight I'm going to talk about high blood pressure. I've entitled the talk, Preventing and Treating High Blood Pressure, Finding the Right Balance of Integrative and Pharmacologic Approaches. But in all honesty, I'm going to talk mostly about pharmacologic approaches, since we have some additional time towards the end of the course to do a specific session on nutrition and diet and health. But I will reflect on some of those issues related to high blood pressure as well. I have no conflicts of interest related to anything I'm going to speak about tonight. Now, high blood pressure is one of the most common conditions among adults. About a third of all adults in the United States meet the current criteria for high blood pressure, which puts it in about the same order of magnitude as obesity, which we'll also talk about towards the end of the course. High blood pressure is, along with cholesterol, one of the very most important risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And this relationship is linear and starts at very low levels of high blood pressure. So even at levels before what we consider high, so in most measures we think of 120, less than 120 millimeters of mercury as the normal blood pressure, even just below those numbers, we begin to see some gradual increased risk. By the time your systolic blood pressure is 20 points higher than that, around 140, your risk has doubled of developing a stroke or heart attack. Now, remember that what we emphasized last session, that when we talk about relative risk, and I talk about something doubling the risk, or in the case of cholesterol, we talked about lowering the risk by a quarter or a third, it depends on what the risk is. So if your risk is very low because you're young and otherwise healthy, then doubling it is not as important than if your risk is high, and now we double that. So the same principle that we talked about with high blood cholesterol applies to hypertension, and it's one of the very important principles we use in treating high blood pressure. That is, we'd like to know not only what your blood pressure is, because that's going to double your risk, but the question is, double what? Now, by the time you get up to 160, another 20 points of systolic high blood pressure doubles your risk again. So now we have a fourfold increased risk of heart attacks and strokes. And that's why we're so concerned about treatment of high blood pressure and why we're really concerned when the number gets really high. So certainly any number over 160 is something that there's universal consensus around the world that we should treat aggressively. The systolic blood pressure predicts heart attacks and strokes and mortality better than the diastolic blood pressure, which is the lower number. And we'll come back to how you measure those two numbers in just a moment. In the older days, when I was in training, the diastolic blood pressure was the primary number we were concerned about. But some studies about that era began to show that it was the systolic hypertension, systolic blood pressure, that actually was the greater predictor. And now we focus on both numbers equally, but as you'll see, the evidence is best for treating high systolic blood pressures. Now, one of the areas we'll talk about is, since the risk starts at relatively low blood pressure levels, then theoretically, one important strategy would be to prevent that blood pressure from increasing as you age. And we call that condition pre-hypertension, or you could call it a high normal blood pressure. And we recommend, in those circumstances, using non-pharmacologic or integrative approaches to treat and lower the blood pressure. And again, I'll come back to some of the specific strategies in a few moments. As I mentioned, about a third of people in the United States have high blood pressure. It's actually 29%. In African Americans, it's a little bit higher. About almost three-quarters of people are treated, and about half are treated well. Now, normally, if this were many other conditions, we would say, well, those numbers don't sound that good. So our first reaction should be that 70% of people treated is way too low. We wouldn't accept that for, say, mammogram screening. And certainly treating effectively only half of the patients at 50% seems like we're not doing well at all. Well, interestingly, although those numbers are certainly imperfect, they're better than almost any other country. So even though the United States compares poorly in international health statistics around many and most health statistics in the developing world, life expectancy and cost, infant mortality and the like, blood pressure control is one of those things that we've just put so much darn energy into as a nation that we're actually doing relatively well. This also reflects, though, that there's a lot more we can do, which is why we're talking about it tonight and why we pay so much attention to this in the office. And some very recent articles, in fact, one just this week, talked again about how many lives we would save if we actually followed the guidelines that I'm going to discuss tonight and treated high blood pressure effectively. The other reason why the number is a little bit lower than you would expect is because we're being very strict in our definition here. We're saying that to be controlled, this should be probably less than 140 and less than 90. So in other words, you have to be both under 140 and under 90. And so that's a fairly high standard. The risk factors for poor control, that is people who are identified but don't have their blood pressure less than 140 and less than 90, are similar to other social determinants of health, race and ethnicity. In this case, the young and the old, 18 to 44 defined as young in this case and over 80. Poverty and less education are all predictors of having less control. There are no surprises there. That's true for most of the endpoints in clinical medicine. Things that predict better control are being insured. That's intuitive. Coming to the doctor at least twice a year. And again, that's because doctors check blood pressure. And so it highlights the engagement with the patient and having a usual source of care. And this is one of the first places in modern medicine where having a usual source of care, or what we commonly call primary care, actually has been shown to be an effective way to treat a condition. So blood pressure control demonstrates the effectiveness of primary care practice. Now, in many ways, this is the most important slide I'm going to show tonight. And so I'm going to spend a fair amount of time on this, and I'm going to come back to this. This may sound extremely basic, but you'll see as we go through the recommendations of who to treat with high blood pressure, it really matters a lot what your number is. And as opposed to a high blood cholesterol or a high blood sugar or a weight, where we can be quite accurate between measurement to measurement, reliable from measurement to measurement of any of those values, there's much more variation in blood pressure from measurement to measurement. Physiologically, that's okay. That just reflects that over the course of the day, there's biologic variation, there's diurnal variation based on the time of the day, based on whether you've smoked a cigarette, whether you've had a cup of coffee, and so on. But there's also what we call a measurement variability or an analytic variability, that the same person taking the same pressure in the same moment twice, boom, boom, may get a variation in measurement between the two. And that's okay. That's just the way it is. And so the point here is that we're looking for averages. And so your risk over time reflects your average blood pressure, or if you will, the area under the curve of your blood pressure, but expecting some variation from measurement to measurement. Given that, though, we must try to decrease the analytic variability. Now, what I'm about to describe is what an accurate blood pressure measurement includes, and you'll see that probably very few of you have had this done. That even in the best clinical settings, we often don't follow this precisely. So one of the important elements is that the recommendations are to be seated for 5 minutes in the chair. So that doesn't mean you've just parked in the parking, you're late to your appointment, you parked in the lot, you race up the elevator, you get there, and you take your blood pressure. And that would, all of these findings, by the way, falsely elevate the blood pressure and are making you more likely to be called hypertensive than you might be. The arm should be bared and supported. So having a blood pressure taken with your clothes on is necessary, depending on the physical setting of some offices, but it increases the blood pressure a little bit. Talking is one of my personal favorites, because that will increase your blood pressure. So when the nurse is taking your history at the same time as he or she is taking your blood pressure, that is not an ideal circumstance. Cigarettes may lead your increase your blood pressure, and coffee in the moment increases your blood pressure, although we'll come back to it, coffee overall is not a risk factor for high blood pressure as a condition. One of the most common errors is a cuff, a blood pressure cuff that's too small. So it's very important that you read the cuff size and make sure when you place it on that you're following the appropriate circumference to get far enough around your arm. For most adults, certainly most middle-aged and older and young old men who have average muscle mass, that a small cuff is too small. And for anyone who's overweight, including about two-thirds of women, a small cuff will also be too small. So about half or more than three-quarters of patients need what we call an intermediate size blood pressure cuff. So one of the things that people make mistakes on is when they purchase machines for home measurements, the cuffs that come with many common machines are too small. Similarly, when you get your blood pressure taken at a health fair or at a pharmacy or in a machine, for example, again, unless there's attention being paid to the size of the cuff, you're at risk of the cuff being too small. Now, the medical students and nursing students and the like are taught to take the blood pressure based on this manual method that we've used for forever. And we block the blood from flowing, and then we slowly release it. And the first sound that comes through is called the first Korotkoff sound, and that represents what we call the systolic blood pressure. So the measurement of your systolic blood pressure is that very first sound. Then we follow, it goes through various other sounds, and when the sound disappears, it's the diastolic blood pressure. So the systolic blood pressure is the top number, the diastolic blood pressure is the lower number. Under ideal practices, even in the same visit, we would want to take multiple readings, and we'd want to average them at least several minutes apart, and we would never call someone hypertension based upon a single visit, unless it's a hypertensive emergency. We want to see multiple elevations over time. So there's no rush here, unless, again, there's a different condition that we call a hypertensive emergency. But just having a high number is not an emergency. The hypertensive emergencies are a very, very high number, and symptoms, or a very, very high number by itself, which is very rare in the United States now. So most of the time, someone will tell you your blood pressure is high, and that's just a nice observation, but it doesn't necessarily in and of itself mean that you have the condition we call hypertension or need treatment. So this is the correct way to do it in the office, and equally importantly, this is the correct way to do it at home if you're checking your own blood pressure. We'll talk about whether you should be checking it at home in just a moment. But what typically happens is you'll see in an office like mine, you'll see the initial blood pressure by the nurse come in quite high. I'll have the patient come back into the room. We'll talk. I'll get on a table. I walk out of the room and say, when I come back in, no more talking, which is great because now I'm back in control of the encounter. And then I take the blood pressure after the patient's been sitting comfortably, and I support the arm, make sure I use the correct cuff. And about half the time, and I haven't, that's not a scientific number, this is now just anecdotal, but about half the time my blood pressure is substantially lower than the medical assistant's. The other half of the time it's about the same. But certainly if it's someone with high blood pressure who I'm going to make a treatment decision based upon the number, I take it myself. And so if you get a high blood pressure encounter when you check in, ask your clinician to retake it after you've been in a condition somewhat more like this to the extent possible. So having an accurate blood pressure measurement is one of the most important things you can do to treat high blood pressure. Now, one of the controversies here is which type of measurement to rely on. And the short answer here is we don't know. And this is an area of research and controversy, and we simply don't know what's best. If you look at all of the clinical trials that I'm going to discuss tonight, which are very similar to the cholesterol trials that we discussed last week, that is people with high blood pressure, carefully defined, who are given a blood pressure medicine or two or three versus sugar pills, and then followed for several years and with outcomes of stroke and heart disease and related outcomes measured. All of those studies were done using office type of measurements. The subjects are volunteers typically. They come to an office, they get a blood pressure measured, they get it measured again, they come back a third time, they get it measured again. It's average, and then you either qualify for the study or not. And that's very similar to what a physician or other clinician would do in their own practice. So the office-based blood pressure is, in fact, historically predictive of the kind of bad outcomes or the kind of risks that make us want to treat high blood pressure. So the office blood pressure is good. Now, it is true, that's assuming you've taken it correctly. It is true that some people have high blood pressure in the office and don't have it at home. And so we have to figure out what to do with that discordance. When that occurs, when it occurs after careful consideration, that's called white coat hypertension, that you have it in the office, but the rest of the time you don't. And usually, especially if the patient is younger, doesn't have a lot of other risk factors, so the overall risk of heart attack and stroke is low, we can watch that patient for quite some time without medications and not really call them hypertensive. However, there are other people in whom the office blood pressure isn't just that the doctor has a white coat or that the being in the office is what makes your pressure go up and then it's low at home, but in fact, when you're driving your car in traffic or you're online at the supermarket or you're taking care of your kids or you're preparing dinner and answering the phone, those are also times that your blood pressure goes up. And those stressful circumstances, and also at work, those stressful circumstances of life correlate pretty well with the office blood pressure. So you have to be fairly careful before you call someone white coat hypertension. Because the common scenario is that people take their blood pressure at home at a time when they're relaxed, often in the evening when blood pressures tend to be a bit lower, and it may be a falsely low blood pressure when in fact you're looking at the whole 24-hour cycle. So if you're going to check your blood pressure at home, it's probably more valuable to check it over the course of a day in different circumstances several times rather than the same time every day if that time is your most relaxed time of the day. Because that will give you your best blood pressure, but it may not be the one that reflects the area under the curve or the average blood pressure. So a third way to get at this, and this is not standard of practice in the United States, and many insurances don't cover this yet, is to use what's called an ambulatory monitor. And this is similar to some of the heart rhythm monitors that people wear, so that you can see when, if you're having irregular heartbeats over a period of, say, 48 hours or a month, depending on the machine. But this is a small little cuff that you wear, and the computer cranks up the pressure and takes the blood pressure every whatever. You can set it for every 15 minutes or every 2 hours or while you're awake. And most people can get through their life without being too bothered by this. You get used to it. And that's really good because it gives you a blood pressure that's in each of those circumstances that combine to reflect your average. And that may be the most accurate. We don't know for sure. And the reason we don't know for sure is because we don't know. We can compare all of these to each other, but we don't know what's the gold standard. So it's hard to tell exactly which is the most accurate. So that's why there is still controversy. But the British have begun to use ambulatory monitoring more routinely, and so I think we'll get a lot more information about this. And in England now, and Britain now, if your office measurement is high, you're often referred for an ambulatory monitor as a confirmatory test. So that's an interesting concept and one that I think has some merit. You could do that at home without an ambulatory monitor. They're not that expensive, by the way. So I think they cost about $150, so it's potentially feasible. You could also do that at home by taking your own blood pressure as long as you're taking it correctly. And as I suggested, mimic the ambulatory monitor by taking it periodically every hour or two during the day rather than at 8 o'clock at night for several days. Now, this next slide is probably too complicated to discuss in great detail, but it is an example of a study from the British literature that tries to compare ambulatory monitoring with home monitoring and the clinic monitoring. And it basically, forget the percentages, 100% in each of these categories would be ideal. This particular study used the ambulatory monitor as the gold standard, but we don't know if that's true. But so it's a big assumption to assume that's the gold standard and the other two aren't. But if you use the ambulatory monitor as the gold standard, what we see is that the home monitor is more sensitive than specific. What that means is it's likely to detect people with high blood pressure particularly well, but it may identify people who don't, in fact, have blood pressure. And the clinic is also balanced. It works, it identifies about three-quarters of the patients accurately. So both have merit. One observation that's important, though, is if you're going to check the home blood pressure, we use 5 millimeters less, that is 135 over 85, is as our abnormal cut point, rather than 140 over 90. And again, that reflects the fact that you're at home and more relaxed and not in your car, not at work, and so forth. So this is very confusing literature. We don't know what's best. Certainly, to summarize, in the United States, the common practice, or the ideal common practice, if that's not too contradictory, would be to have it checked accurately in the office, not overinterpret that, not panic when the number's a little high. If you're on the brink of needing medications and you want to get some additional information, it's okay to check it at home, but check it with an appropriate-sized cuff under the same conditions, but not just when you're home and relaxed, but rather in other settings as well, including work and so forth. An ambulatory monitor, I think, is provocative, and if it was available and inexpensive, I would recommend it enthusiastically as another data point. So I think we may find ourselves moving in that direction. All right. This is the only slide I'm going to show tonight on the non-drug treatment of hypertension or the integrative approach to high blood pressure control. And I will come back to this in, I think, three weeks, and we'll talk about this in much more detail. But this lists the five things that are most evidence-based, have been best demonstrated in the medical literature to be effective at treating high blood pressure without medications. By far and away, the best is if you're overweight, and even a little overweight, and have high blood pressure, if you lose weight, your blood pressure will almost uniformly come down. That's true for high triglycerides. It's also true for high blood sugar. But it's one of those very, very reliable phenomenon that if you're overweight and have some of those metabolic abnormalities and you lose weight, your blood pressure comes down. And about, if you lose 20 pounds, about 10 kilograms, you can lower your blood pressure by anywhere from 10 to 20 millimeters of mercury. So it can be a very substantial change, which is durable for a while. And the for a while is in part because two things are fighting that. One is you're likely to gain the weight back statistically, and two, you're aging, and that in itself increases blood pressure in our society. It's not part of the human experience biologically, though, I should say. There are peoples around the planet who don't have high blood pressure as they age, but in the developed world, that is the norm. So weight loss for the overweight, and that's also true if you're 100 pounds overweight. You don't have to lose 100 pounds. If you lose 20 pounds, also your blood pressure will come down quite reliably. Alcohol works in some patients. You don't have to become a teetotaler, but if you're drinking, quote, heavily, more than three or four drinks a day, depending on men and women of three and four, then if you lower that to zero or one drink a day, the blood pressure will come down in moderately in some patients. So it's not always reliable, doesn't always occur, but it's an option, especially for people who are thin, who are using alcohol regularly. Salt is a little controversial, but not really here. So the controversies related to salt, which we'll discuss when we come back to this in 3 weeks, are related to population-based sodium control. That is, should we have everyone on a low-salt diet? That's where there are some controversies. And the controversies also are about how low it should go. But in the context of an individual patient with high blood pressure who wants to try to lower their blood pressure without medications, who happens to be a higher salt user, and particularly if that person is older or African American, and that what we call salt sensitive, in that circumstance, restricting your dietary salt works much of the time. Not everyone, but much of the time. So it is one of the, if you're not overweight and you're not a drinker, it's sort of next on the list of things you can do if your sodium intake is high. And again, we'll get more quantitative about this later in the course, but somewhere around 2.5 grams of sodium per day is the magic number. You can go a little bit lower than that, and you get more effect. The DASH diet stands for Dietary Alternatives to Stop Hypertension Diet, and it has this name because it was part of a study funded by the NIH. And was shown to be effective. And the DASH diet, we'll also talk about, is really just what we would all in the room consider a healthy diet, or a heart-healthy diet, or a guidelines-consistent diet. So a diet high in fresh fruits and vegetables, low in processed foods, high in fiber, and so on. That kind of approach, and again, we'll drill down to that much more granularly later in the course, in and of itself, if your starting diet is unhealthy, can be very effective. And the good news is that the dietary sodium and a heart-healthy diet, a healthy diet as a way to reduce blood pressure, are additive to each other. So they each work alone, and they work better together. Now, it's one of the things that's really interesting about salt is that most of the things that are high in salt are also high in calories. And so if you focus on common high-calorie foods, your sodium will often go down. And again, we'll go through that. And so all this is quite aligned. That is, you may lose weight, your salt intake will decrease, and you'll eat more dietary fiber, more potassium, more fruits and vegetables, and some of the elements that we think work on a DASH diet. The other thing that's really interesting about salt restriction in this context is that it's been proven that people lose their salt taste preference over time. So calories, it's sort of a lifelong struggle. If you have a weight issue, that's something that you'll have to struggle with for most of your life. But for sodium, if you can go on a really low, if you like salty foods, in other words, I put a blindfold on you and have you taste foods, and you pick the higher salty foods, and then I put you on a low salt diet for a period of time, around 2 months or so, and then bring you back and test you again, you will now no longer prefer the high salt foods. So you can retrain your salt preferences with salt restriction, whereas that's not true as easily with some other nutritional entities. However, as we'll discuss in a few weeks, most salt doesn't come from your adding salt at the table or the stove. Most salt in the diet comes from processed foods. And again, we'll come back to that. And then finally, physical activity, 30 minutes a day. We'll say more about that later in the course as well. Also can be used to lower blood pressure. And there's a dose response curve here. The more you exercise, the greater the reduction in blood pressure. Your blood pressure, of course, goes up during exercise, so that's confusing sometimes. You're using more muscles. Your body needs more blood flow, so your pressure goes up. And that's normal. If your blood pressure did not go up during exercise, that's actually a sign of heart disease. So that's confusing, but your blood pressure goes up with exercise, but then on average, after exercising, your blood pressure is lower. And finally, coffee is sort of the Teflon nutrient. No matter how people have looked to try to blame things on habitual caffeine use, at least as found in coffee, it's been unsuccessful. And this another new study just came out this week on this as well, that habitual caffeine consumption is not associated with a risk of high blood pressure and, in fact, has not yet been associated with the risk of almost any cardiovascular illness. It can be associated with atrial fibrillation in people who are predisposed, and it can cause acid stimulation for people who have gastrointestinal issues and diarrhea and other issues. So it's not benign, and insomnia and nerve anxiety. There are plenty of things that coffee can make you sick from with, but cardiovascular disease is not one of them. Okay. So at the beginning of this course, the whole point is that there are a lot of new guidelines this year. And the reason for doing this course is because there's a lot of new information and a lot of confusing guidelines. When it comes to high blood pressure, the guideline that has been most durable and affects most clinicians in practice in the United States is that it's called the Joint National Commission Report. And this is now up to number 8. So cholesterol, we were up guideline number 4, and I said the first one was in 1988. I don't actually remember when the first JNC report was, but it was substantially before that. So this has been one of our first sort of guideline businesses that we've had for decades in the United States. And again, I think it's part of this reason why we've been successful at treating high blood pressure. Now, in the past, this guideline, like many other guidelines, were developed with a group of experts reviewing the literature and reaching recommendations by voting and consensus. And they typically would look at a very wide variety of evidence. And I think I made a similar comment about the new cholesterol guidelines, in that in the prior guidelines, any type of evidence could inform the opinion of the experts. And so there are different people who think about what happens in an animal as being more important than other people, or what happens in an observational study over time, or what happens in a test tube, or what should happen physiologically. But this particular set of guidelines, analogous to the cholesterol new guidelines, only looks at randomized clinical trials, that is, those big studies that I described before, where people are carefully identified as having elevated blood pressure, They're given blood pressure treatment with one, two, or three medicines versus sugar pills in a way that no one knows which is which, including the patient and the doctors. And then their outcomes are measured over a period of time, usually about 5 years, looking at how often people get strokes, heart attacks, and cardiovascular death. And so it's a much more rigorous type of clinical science. It's our gold standard type of study. And the reason why people get so confused about reading the newspaper about science, particularly as regard nutrition and exercise, and my personal pet peeve is the column in the New York Times, which almost every day tells you you should do something different with your exercise regimen based upon a study in Europe in 12 people. That's not what this is about. These are big randomized trials with large numbers, usually thousands of patients, followed for a long period of time. And looking at those studies, of which there are a little more than a dozen or two, the commission only tried to answer three questions. Now, the good news is they were the right questions. So it's what we care about as patients, and it's what we care about as clinicians. And the questions are, does treatment, RX stands for treatment, does treatment at a specific blood pressure threshold improve the outcome? That is, if you pick a number and start there and treat people based upon a number, do you have fewer strokes and heart attacks? Number two, if you start at a certain number and then treat to a certain goal, does that particular goal lead to better outcomes? And third, does it matter what medication we use? So those are good questions, and that's what most of the management of blood pressure relies on. Traditionally, we've said 140 over 90 is our threshold. Our goal traditionally has been less than 140 and less than 90. So for some patients, it doesn't require moving very far to need a treatment and then be at goal. And there have been a wide range of medications available to treat high blood pressure. And the question is, are they all the same, or should we have preferences amongst the classes of medications? So to answer these three questions, it added up to about to nine recommendations, and I will go through them. Now, the first one is actually, in many respects, the most controversial, but probably the most important. The evidence for this was high-quality evidence, what we call grade-A evidence, came from six randomized trials involving a lot of patients, all over 60 years old. And what it said was that if you started treating people at 150, you had less bad outcomes. That suggested that you don't have to treat over 140, but rather in patients over 60, we can let it ride a little bit higher and still get benefit if we use 150 as the threshold. Similarly, 90 was the threshold for the lower number, although the evidence is stronger, that is, the trials were better designed to answer the question about the top number, the systolic. In these studies, where the threshold was picked at anyone over 150, the goal was just less than 150. And so this is not a comparison of 140 versus 150. Right? We don't have studies that specifically answer that question, which would be a question that we would want to know the answer to. But rather, this answers the question, if we start at 150 and lower people's blood pressure, does it work? And the answer is yes, it works. So that is now the, based upon the six randomized trials, that is now the current recommendation for people over age 60 who don't have any of the other conditions that I'm going to discuss. And like I said, this comes from six studies of patients. They're American studies and European studies. I apologize for the abbreviation of the studies. They're not important except to show that this isn't just one study. but rather a wide variety of studies involving a large number of patients, thousands, tens of thousands. There is some evidence comparing less than 160 to less than 140 and less than 150 to less than 140. The evidence isn't super strong, but the trend of this evidence is that 140 is not better than 150. And the reason, and that is why the recommendation has been made to use 150. And a recent study came out again this week, reanalyzing the literature in a different way, trying to answer the same question. At what point does intensifying treatment, was the headline, begin to work? And again, it was over 150 where most of the action was. Now, just to illustrate this, I'm going to show one study. It doesn't exactly fit. It's one of the studies on this list, the so-called HIVET study. But it not only answers the question about people over 60, but it answers the question about people over 80. So this was 4,000 patients, and it was designed to answer the question of, does it make sense to treat high blood pressure late in life? You may remember that when we were talking about cholesterol, we mentioned that over age 75, cholesterol is no longer a very accurate risk factor to predict who's going to get a heart attack or stroke. And I made the joke that I often offer people at age 75 to discontinue their cholesterol medication. And I also made the comment that that's not true for hypertension, and this study is why. So what they did in this study was they took people whose blood pressure was over 160, and they treated them to get down less than 150. The average blood pressure was a bit higher. It was actually 170. They used a diuretic. Indapamide is a thiazide-type diuretic. In this country, it would be equivalent to using hydrochlorothiazide or chlorothalidone more commonly, or hydrochlorothiazide more commonly, but or chlorothalidone. Perindopril is a ACE inhibitor, and here we would use benazepril or lisinopril, but it's the same class. So this is a diuretic and an ACE inhibitor as a second drug if needed versus a sugar pill. It was only a two-year study. And what they showed in the column that's labeled on the your right, hazard ratio, the hazard ratio means if you subtract from 1, you'll get the percent reduction. So in other words, what this study showed is that people who were taking medications had 36% less stroke, 45% less heart attack, 45% less cardiovascular deaths, 72% less heart failure, 27% less cardiovascular death, and 28% death from all causes. Now, it's almost never seen in a cardiovascular type study or any study for that matter that you actually can affect all-cause mortality, and especially not in 2 years. So this is a remarkable finding that individuals this late in life who take two commonly used medications versus not taking them, live longer. And not only do they live longer, but they live, quote, better because they're not getting strokes and heart attacks. So that's really quite remarkable, and these results were all highly statistically significant. The other thing was that the benefits appear at after only 1 year of treatment. So, again, this is quite remarkable. And, again, I think, if you think back to my first comment last week, the reason why this is working so well is because these are people who are 80, right? So their risk of having a stroke or a heart attack is really, really high to begin with. Then when we lower it, now we're preventing a lot of events. As opposed to if we did this study in 40-year-olds, it still might lower the risk, but we're starting with a very low number, and therefore we're not getting much benefit. So it's the same principle with cholesterol that is with high blood pressure. The greater your risk of having an event, the greater the benefit of lowering that risk. And we can actually quantify how many people you have to treat in order to get that benefit. And you only have to treat 20 people up for a year to prevent one stroke. And in a preventive medicine context, that's a very low number. And if we converted that to cost effectiveness, which is another way to work these numbers, it also would be extremely cost effective. So this study made the point, and there had been other studies leading up to this that made us anticipate this result, it was just the best study, that you're never too old to treat a high systolic blood pressure, and the goal does not have to be less than 140, that going from 160 to 150, in this case, save lives. Now, again, that's not the perfect analogy to our recommendation. Remember, the main recommendation we're still talking about is that people over 60 were changing the threshold from 140 to 150 to start therapy. So this would be an example of how we might apply this in clinical practice. This is a 73-year-old woman. Her blood pressure, after multiple measurements, averages 148 over 88. She doesn't have diabetes or kidney dysfunction. She's otherwise well. She's maximized her non-pharmacologic or integrative therapy. And the next best therapy is to continue current therapy, begin hydrochlorothiazide, an ACE inhibitor, a calcium channel blocker, or a beta blocker. These are the four of the classes of drugs we use commonly. And the correct answer is she does not need treatment at this time. So that's a change in our practice. Just a year ago, we would have said you need to be on a medication. Now, if you're on a medication that was started under these circumstances and you're doing okay, then the current guideline is not to stop. So there'll be a temptation, I think, for everyone to say, well, you know, maybe I was started too early and maybe I can come off the medication. And that is not a compelling part of this recommendation. Now, it may be in individual circumstances or individual patients that it's worth considering that. So if people are on lots of medication, having trouble with side effects, costs, what we call polypharmacy, and drug interactions and the like, then sometimes it may be worth reconsidering that now that the guideline is, quote, a little bit looser. But if you're comfortable with where you are, it's fine to stay where you are. And the reason for that is that this is just this year's guideline. This is not written in stone. This is not a law. This is not a guarantee that the recommendation will stay the same for the rest of your life. And different other groups of smart people have come up with different conclusions. So within the United States, there are other panels of experts that don't agree with this. Although I will say that in general around the world, the trend is moving in this direction. So the English have even a higher threshold. They use 160 a lot of the time. And many of the other developed nations also use slightly lower threshold, higher thresholds, less aggressive therapy for people over 60. And as this evidence is what we call grade E, means weak, A being good. So by the time you get down to E, it's just expert opinion. It's not really evidence-based, but it's sort of common sense that if you're doing okay, it's fine to stay the course. In the same way that many of my patients say, I know you told me I can stop my lipid at 75, but I want to leave it alone on my statin. And so it would be the same thing here. If you're doing okay, it's fine to stay on it. But there are some patients who are treated for that number at 140 where the lower number gets really, really low. And some of those patients may have side effects. And there's some concern that if that lower number gets really, really low, it may not create enough pressure to fill your heart when the heart is relaxing. And so that's part of the logic of not over-treating high blood pressure in the elderly. But mostly that it's sometimes people get dizzy when they stand up and so on, and that may be a sign that we need to back off a little bit. Okay, now that's over 60. Under 60, there's no change. We're still using 140 and 90. The evidence is stronger for the diastolic blood pressure because in younger people, most of the studies that are older studies were designed to test, they just included patients based upon their diastolic blood pressure. But the take-home message is the same for both systolic and diastolic. Under age 60, the recommendations are the same, less than 140 and less than 90. Where this controversy is what age to start. And this is analogous to the controversy for high blood cholesterol. As briefly went over last week, many experts recommend starting cholesterol-lowering medicines at age 21. in certain circumstances. Other experts, including the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, would say for low-risk people, closer to 35 in men and 45 in women. And the same controversy exists in blood pressure control. There are many smart people who think starting young prevents a lifelong of high blood pressure type damage, and therefore we should start young. There are other people who say the risk is really low. I can't make a low number better, and therefore I'm going to wait till the risk is higher. And that tension, that controversy exists. So shown here, starting at age 30, I think most people recommend treatment, 30, 35, to be consistent with cholesterol. But younger than that is where the controversy is, and there's a lot of strong opinions, and we don't know the truth. And the question you're asking as you're trying to answer this question, since no one's going to have a stroke between 18 and 29, what you're asking is 40 years of blood pressure medicine better than 30? And we don't know the answer to that. We're never going to know the answer to that. But that's really, if you think about it, that's what this is about. And most of us think, at least I should say, I think, and most of my local colleagues think, but not depends on their backgrounds, I think that since there's no evidence that 40 years of treatment is better than 30 years of treatment, I do think you can wait. And so I favor the starting at age 30 or so under most circumstances. And as I said, the second part of this is using 140 for the systolic. It's interesting. This is a grade E as far as the evidence. That is, the evidence isn't strong. And that's simply because the studies were designed based on the diastolic blood pressure. But you can then analyze the data and say, yeah, 140 seems like the right number for most people. So the 150 is only for people over 60 years old. All right, now what about kidney disease? So this has been important because there's been a recommendation in the both the general literature and the certainly the kidney literature that treating people who have chronic kidney disease, that you should treat them aggressively, both with cholesterol lowering, blood sugar if they have diabetes, and most importantly, blood pressure. And so the recommendation has been to treat individuals with kidney disease starting at 130. Some people would even say 120. But when you review the evidence, it's hard to come to that conclusion. So if you most experts, although not all, and some of the kidney specialists disagree with this, but the general recommendation now is that even if you have some kidney disease, we can use 140 as a threshold. And I'll show you a study that's an example of that in just a moment. So we don't have proof that using 130 as the threshold or 120 as the threshold is any better than using 140. And again, many clinicians disagree with that. They'll treat kidney patients more aggressively than this. And again, if you're doing fine and that's the way your nephrologist recommends it, by all means, stay on that medication. But the new guideline is to back off a little bit if you're treating a chronic kidney disease. Now, the new definitions of kidney disease are a little bit different. It's a separate conversation. But it's not just what your kidney function is in the laboratory, but also how much protein you have in the urine. So that's another. Some of you may encounter being asked to check urine for protein, which we used to do and we still do routinely in patients with kidney disease, known kidney disease, and diabetes. But also now we probably will do that occasionally on patients with high blood pressure alone. Because, again, if we identify proteinuria, we do act a little bit differently. Not on this slide. The number is still 140, but in a later slide, and I'll show you why in a moment. So the take-home message here is no special treatment for kidney disease, at least as far as thresholds and goals. Diabetes, it's sort of the same story. There's been an argument that the number should be 130 as the threshold, 130 and 80 as the threshold. For about a decade, the studies that have looked at this more closely have not been adequate to prove that that's more effective. And so the current recommendation with diabetes is, again, 140 over 90. So those are both. So kidney disease and diabetes and age are three of the big changes in these new recommendations to back off a little bit on all three of those. So this is an example of the kind of study that has been designed to address some of these questions. So this is RCT, stands for randomized controlled trial, the kind of studies we've been talking about, of 5,000 patients who had type 2 diabetes. And they compared 120 versus 140. I was a little frustrated when this first came out because the guideline was 130, not 120. And so what we really wanted to know was 130 better than 140. But whatever, they did 120. And it turned out, if you look at the cardiovascular events versus death, which was the primary outcome of the study, there was no benefit of treating to a lower threshold. So that is to say the people on 140 had the same amount of events as the people who were treated to 120. And you know it's the same based on the fact that it was not statistically significant over here. So these two numbers look slightly different, but they're actually the same statistically based upon the test of statistical significance. There was a slight difference in stroke rate, but the overall risk of stroke was low. And so it didn't have much impact on the overall endpoint, which was the combined outcome. So again, different people interpret the same study differently. But the primary design of the study was total events plus death, and that was negative. And so the people who funded the study, which happened to be the NIH, said that treating to 120 did not reduce the rate of combined fatal and non-fatal events. And therefore, the recommendation is now 140. And there are other studies like this. Again, a little bit controversial. Plenty of diabetologists who prefer it to be lower, but this is the current guideline. Okay, so now let's talk about choice of medication. This has been a fun thing to watch. As I mentioned, we're now in the eighth set of recommendations. And this is a pendulum that's swung back and forth a few times. We don't have that many new classes of medicines. I'll have a long list of medicines towards the end. But we've been using thiazide-type diuretics for a long time, decades. We've been using calcium channel blockers for less long, but now getting on a long, long time. And so-called ACE inhibitors, or angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, also for 25, 30 years. Angiotensin receptor blockers, or so-called ARBs, the sartan-type drugs, are a little bit newer, but just a little bit. And there have been times where the recommendation said just use a thiazide first. There have been times where it was said use a thiazide or a beta blocker first. There have been times where it says we don't care, use any one of those, the four categories. And now we're a little bit back to the we don't care except for sometimes. And what I mean by that is that beta blockers are no longer on the starting list. And so that's a change. And that comes from a long list of studies which have looked at the role of beta blockers that show them to be still effective at preventing strokes or heart attacks, but less so than these other drugs. So beta blockers have moved into the fourth position, if you will, as a class of drugs. I say fourth rather than fifth because we don't use ACE inhibitors and the ARBs together. So although it's listed as four categories, in reality it's one of three categories because it's either ACE or ARB. And we used to have a preference because some were more expensive depending on when they came out, and now as the pricing has come down as they've gone generic, you can pick either an ACE or an ARB relatively with impunity. So that's the list. So and there's no recommendations on this list as to which goes first. And I'll go through some of the characteristics of the drugs now. But it used to be that we had preferences, and that's no longer the case. I used to be one of the people who had a strong feeling about diuretics first, because that's been more or less the guideline most of the time, and it was the first drug that was really cheap. So hydrochlorothiazide is virtually free, costs pennies per pill compared to some of the other drugs. And then when the others especially were on patent, they were very expensive. So I was a big thiazide fan. So I often used to teach use thiazides first. Then there were some studies which said maybe it doesn't matter so much. And then I would say, well, if you didn't use thiazide first, at least use it second. And now based on this guideline, what I'd have to say is at least use thiazide as one of your top three. So you should not be on three drugs without a thiazide, but it no longer has to be your first medication. Now, having said that, thiazides have been around for the longest. They're very effective for systolic blood pressure, which is predominantly what we care about, especially in older folks. There have been a lot of things that the people who made other drugs used to blame on thiazides. So for those of you who remember this literature or being told different things, for a while we thought that people who took thiazides had more sudden cardiac death, that it didn't work to make your heart wall less thick, that it raised your blood cholesterol or your blood sugar, and that you couldn't use it in kidney disease. It turned out all of those things are false. So thiazides have been a durable sort of a little bit like the caffeine analogy, have been a durable medication that's still very inexpensive, very effective, and particularly effective in people, in African Americans and older individuals who have more, quote, salt-sensitive high blood pressure. The dose of thiazides has been fun because when I was a medical student, the dose of my patients was 50 twice a day, or 100 milligrams a day of hydrochlorothiazide, and everyone had to take potassium supplements. And so then when I was a resident, it went down, you know, we said, nah, let's just use 50. And then when I became faculty, it went down to 25, and then we realized, well, you know, a lot of older people do fine on 12 and a half. And so often we start with 12 and a half or 25, but it is worth noting that 50 is more effective at lowering your blood pressure than 12 than 25. The problem is it causes more low blood potassium. And so you then have to take another drug to chase the potassium, whether it's a potassium supplement or a different type of diuretic and the like. One thing that people forget, and again, this will be a little bit more relevant when we talk about diet, a lot of times people think, well, a diuretic means that you're putting out salt, which is partly how it works, although it has other effects to lower your blood pressure. And so people think, well, since I'm on a diuretic, I don't have to worry about how much salt I eat, right, because I'm on a diuretic. And in fact, the complete opposite is true. And without going through all the details of the physiology, suffice it to say that in the kidney, the predictor of how much potassium you lose is a function of how much sodium gets to a certain part of the kidney. So if you're eating a lot of sodium or a lot of salt and on a medication that's poisoning certain parts of your kidney against reabsorbing salt, then the sodium gets to that part of the distal kidney, the distal loop, where it exchanges for potassium and you end up putting out more potassium. So if you're having trouble with low potassium as a function of being on a diuretic or a water pill, one of the solutions might be a lower dose, but another solution might be adding another diuretic which saves potassium. A third option might be eating more potassium, which is healthy and may lower blood pressure. But probably the most important is to eat less salt, because then you deliver less salt to the distal tubule and you lose less potassium. So that's an underappreciated strategy for treating low potassium and also reduces your blood pressure. The other drugs are more or less equivalent as far as blood pressure lowering is shown here. But as I mentioned, they're not all equivalent in terms of what happens to stroke and heart attacks, and that's really what we care about. So sometimes you'll hear about a new drug, and they'll advertise it or it'll get approved by the FDA because it lowers blood pressure by some number, 10 over 5 or 12 over 6 or whatever. And people will be tempted to use this new drug. But I urge caution, because just because the number goes in the right direction doesn't mean there will be less heart attacks and strokes. And so the advantage of the of a drug like hydrochlorothiazide and some of these others, similarly to the statins that we talked about last week, is that we have all of these big studies that compare them to a sugar pill and show that there are less strokes and less heart attacks or save lives, and that's what we care about. So don't get fooled. You won't, but don't let your clinicians get fooled by people selling drugs where the approval process was based on the number of blood pressure, but not the event rate of strokes and heart attacks, because that's really what we care about, not the number. The number's a marker. Now, beta blockers, as I mentioned, are off the list, and the main reason is they just don't work as well to prevent stroke. And as you get older, and especially in women, stroke becomes increasingly an important part of the cardiovascular disease picture, and so it's fallen a little bit off the list. It still works, and that's an important thing. People think, oh, it doesn't work, which is why it's off the list. It still works to prevent heart attacks and strokes, just not as well as the other three classes of drugs. So it's a perfectly good drug, but probably goes into fourth place or fifth place rather than first or second place, which is where it was for much of the last several decades. Beta blockers, have gotten a bad name in terms of side effects. It turns out they do not cause depression or sexual dysfunction any more than other drugs or hypertension by itself. The one side effect that is common for some patients is more fatigue. And so some patients do well with beta blockers, some less well. Of course, if you've had a heart attack, you must be on a beta blocker, because it prevents recurrent heart attacks. Separate conversation. So it's not that beta blockers are a bad drug by any means. They're a life-saving drug. But as an initial drug for high blood pressure, they've fallen a little bit out of favor. And I'll give you the names of all the drugs in these different categories in a moment. The ACE inhibitors and the angiotensin receptor blockers were newer drugs, 20 years ago or so, but they've now been around a long period of time. They've turned out to be very durable and very effective. They are not safe in pregnancy, and so we don't recommend them, at least casual use, in women of reproductive age. And we'll come back to their use in people with renal disease in just a moment. But the take-home message is that they do work. You can use it. It does prevent renal dysfunction in the right set of patients. It's not better than other drugs, but it's as good as other drugs. And as we've gotten more experience with these drugs and the prices come down, they're more commonly on the short list of drugs we'll use first. Again, now, first, second, or third. The other take-home point is we don't like to use these together. We used to think we could do that. There were some studies in patients with heart failure where we use these drugs a lot, and also in kidney disease where we use these drugs a lot. Where they were combined, and at first it looked like they were better together than either alone, and that has not been true when bigger studies were done. So almost no one now recommends using them together. And calcium channel blockers are also an interesting story, because when they first came out, they were short-acting medicines, and they were very effective at lowering blood pressure. And then some studies started coming out suggesting that they actually increased the risk of heart attacks. So they went out of favor for some time, and they were marketed very aggressively. But then longer-acting channel blockers were developed, and they've turned out to be quite good drugs. So we do use them now in the top three. And like I said, I used to say that the first or second drug should be a diuretic. And this is the type of study that led to the recommendations that now make me say that you need to be on a diuretic for one of your top three drugs. This was a study that compared ACE inhibitors with hydrochlorothiazide plus hydrochlorothiazide versus an ACE inhibitor and a calcium channel blocker, and the patients were followed for 3 years. As you can see, it was a very large study. Patients were over 65. a little bit more men than women, but included a lot of women, and more Caucasians, and a lot of diabetics. Again, typical study looked at combined endpoints. It is noteworthy that it was funded by the drug company that made amlodipine, but it was a rigorously done study, and it was in the United States and Europe. And it's the only study that's shown this, but the results are very noteworthy. And again, using that same format I showed earlier, subtracting from 1.0, you can see that the ultimate event rate was decreased by 20%. In the people who used the ACE inhibitor and amlodipine together without a diuretic compared to those that used the ACE inhibitor and a diuretic. So as you go down the list, some of these numbers cross one and are not statistically significant, like cardiovascular death and strokes and revascularization. But again, the primary output endpoint was all events, as combined events. And it did show that although both sets of drugs are effective, the benazepril and amlodipine group did better. Does this mean everyone should be on that combination? Probably not. It's the only study that's been designed to answer this question. We don't like to change our practice based upon a single study. But at least it means it's not worse. And again, it allows us to say that any combination of those first three drugs are all fine, that thiazides don't have to be first or second anymore. They can be third. All right, back to our recommendations. Now, for African Americans, the earlier slide in terms of drug selection was for non-African Americans. For African Americans, the ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers are not recommended as initial drugs. The evidence for this isn't super strong, but the thiazide diuretics and calcium channel blockers are a bit more effective. So most people now recommend using one of these two classes of drugs in African Americans first. Now, one place where a specific drug does have benefit is chronic kidney disease. So I mentioned that we are no longer recommending a different treatment threshold or goal, but we are recommending a different drug if the patient has chronic kidney disease, and that's one of the ACE or ARB drugs. Not both, but one of them as the drug of first choice. Many physicians would extend this to diabetes as well, but it really only applies to patients with diabetes who have chronic kidney disease, as defined by either protein in the urine or an abnormal kidney function test. Despite that, if I say diabetes with hypertension, almost every physician would say ACE inhibitor or ARB. But the evidence is not super strong for that. But it's not worth fighting because ACEs and ARBs are a perfectly good drug. They just don't have any special role unless you actually have kidney disease. And then the final recommendations are actually a potpourri of common sense. If the goal isn't reached within a month, we increase the dose or add a second drug. And again, mix and match from those three classes. And we keep assessing the blood pressure until the goal is reached. We talked about not using ACE and ARB together. And if you can't do it with those three, we have another list. So there are options, but there's one thing to do before you get to that other list, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. Now, if you're a fundamentalist when it comes to evidence, and you really want to only use products that have been studied themselves, then there is a list of medicines, and this is analogous to the list I showed you for cholesterol-lowering medicines, where I gave you a list of what we now call moderate-intensity and high-intensity statins. I took off the doses here because it's too much information, but there are drugs that are generics in each of these major categories that are on everyone's formulary, so there's no problem here. So each of these drugs are available in the United States, and at least one of them is on your list. And we don't think within the category that one is better than the other. So, in other words, if your insurance recommends lisinopril instead of enalapril, fine. Losartan instead of valsartan, fine, and so on. Those are the ones that have been proven in these big studies to prevent strokes and heart attacks. For the beta blockers, when we do use them, it's atenolol or metoprolol. The calcium channel blockers, it's amlodipine and diltiazem predominantly. And for the thiazide-type diuretics, it's predominantly hydrochlorothiazide. Most of us don't use chlorothalidone or the others. So those are the drugs. And again, it doesn't really matter within the class. So your clinician picks one from each class. And it doesn't really matter which one you start with because most people need more than one drug. And so there's a lot of literature saying, well, this would be the best single drug in some people, and this would be the best single drug in other people. And it turns out it doesn't matter that much because most people need more than one drug. As we talked about, we start with one and then add a second. For many patients, the standard way to do it is just take it up to the highest dose before you add the second drug. That's a little bit easier. You only have one prescription rather than two. But some people don't get side effects at the higher dose, and it's also fine to use a medium dose of both drugs and mix and match. So there are lots of ways to do this. Now, if you get to three drugs and your blood pressure is not controlled, then it's time to stop and have a conversation. This is called resistant hypertension, and it's quite common. Remember I said that half of the population is not controlled. Not all of them would qualify as resistant hypertension, but because they're not on three drugs, they may not be on adequate one or two drugs. But if you're on three drugs, including a diuretic, and your blood pressure is not controlled, then we call that resistant hypertension, just by convention. Most of the time in the real world, this is because patients aren't taking their medication. Again, the statistics on this are extremely humbling. Depending on the study and depending on the drug, it's somewhere, sometimes it's less than 50% of what's prescribed by a doctor is actually taken by a patient. And that's true for drugs, even pain medicine that you think people would really want to take, or hormone replacement therapy that you think people would feel better if they need it or if they really need it. It's true for birth control pills in spades. The data on people missing birth control pills is quite striking and humbling, which is why we recommend long-acting contraceptives whenever we can. And there are a variety of other reasons. These drugs do cause some side effects in some patients. Again, just because a drug says it might cause a side effect doesn't mean you're going to get that side effect. Most side effects are less than 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 20. But there are expense issues and insurance reasons and just I don't like to take pills and a wide variety of reasons. So adherence is 1, 2, and 3 on the list. But anti-inflammatory drugs, decongestants, and methamphetamine and other stimulants increase your blood pressure. And so that's a common cause of poor blood pressure control. Also, that should be on this list is dietary indiscretion. So people who are gaining weight and people are eating a large amount of sodium also have a greater risk of resistant hypertension. So it's worth thinking about why rather than just adding a fourth or a fifth drug, because most of the time it's adherence and you can write as many prescriptions as you want, but the patient doesn't take it. There is a long list, a medium list of other conditions, diseases that cause what we call secondary hypertension, some endocrine disorders and some kidney disorders, blood flow disorders. But they're not that common with the exception of kidney disease, and that's usually easy to detect because we measure that in the blood test. So these other causes, which we do think about and we do evaluate you for, are not common. It's almost always poor adherence or some other medication or diet that's interfering. Now, if, though, you don't have that, you just have blood pressure that can't be controlled, there's a long list of other medicines. And I won't go through all of these, but except to know these are all good medicines. Some of them are older medicines, so we don't use them as often. But they all have a role, and there are very few patients that need a fourth drug, though, if you're really taking your medication. Certainly if you're taking your medication and your non-drug therapy, which not only works as an initial therapy, but is also additive to drug therapy, that is, allows you to take less doses of medication, then you rarely need a fourth or fifth drug. Spironolactone is one we like. Beta blockers are on this list. Labetalol is a type of beta blocker that we use. It's an alpha and beta blocker, and so on. So there are a lot of good drugs. So we can get almost everyone's blood pressure under control if they take their medications. So let me just end by saying a few words about some ideal circumstances or different circumstances to the way we do it. I mentioned that the British have thought about this quite a bit, and their approach is provocative and interesting. They do a couple of things different than we do. Number one, like I said, if your blood pressure is high in the office, they send you home with an ambulatory monitor to confirm it. And that is very logical based upon our understanding of the variation over the course of a day and over the course of several days of your blood pressure. What they also do is use that same logic that is not in the American guidelines, but the same logic that we talked about a lot about cholesterol. They calculate your risk. We still don't know which risk calculator to use, same problem we had last week. That doesn't go away. But if your risk is high, then again, lowering that risk is more likely to be beneficial than if your risk is low. So they look for damage to the body from having high blood pressure, which we can do on examination and with testing. They treat blood pressure less than 160, only if there are complicating conditions. And they use 160 as their office measurement to treat. So in the United States, and I wrote 155 because they're using a home measurement, so again, it would be lower than the office measurement. So they actually use 155 at home or 160 in the office as the treatment in people who don't have any damage from high blood pressure. So they weigh in on the, is 40 years better than 30 years or 20 years? They strongly weigh in on the, we can wait till 20 years, with the logic being that you want to start taking your medicines about 10 years before your first heart attack or stroke. So it's the same with high blood pressure as it is with cholesterol. So this is an interesting approach, and it's different than ours, but it does suggest that even though we've let it drift up to 150, we're probably not being cuckoo about this because for many individuals, they let it ride to 160. The other program I wanted to highlight is Kaiser Northern California, who really has made a tremendous quality control effort to treat blood pressure. And instead of 50 or 47% control in the national average, I think in Northern California in general, it's about 55 or 60% control. They get up to 80-plus percent control. And I think since they published this, they're well above 80 now. And what they do is they keep track of all their patients in an integrated system who have high blood pressure. They share those performance metrics, like are you prescribing the right medicine, are you measuring the right tests and so forth, are you taking the blood pressure right amongst the doctors so they can see their own performance. They follow the guidelines. And they also allow the pharmacist and the medical assistant to make therapeutic decisions. So in their system, you don't need to see a doctor or a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant to get blood pressure adjusted. You can just work with a pharmacist to do that. And more we're moving in that direction in other settings. They also use a combination pill, which is two drugs in the same pill to improve adherence, and that works for some patients. All right, so let me just summarize. The key points of the current recommendations, and again, no change in the recommendations about non-drug therapy, but I'll drill down on those in 3 weeks, but it's still for borderline blood pressure or above any of the thresholds, it's still effective to use non-pharmacologic therapy first and continue it throughout the period because it allows you to use lower doses of medicines. The big changes are that for patients over 60, we now will let it ride up to 150 rather than 140. Everyone else, 140 is probably good enough. Our efforts to treat people at 130 and 120 have not panned out. For non-blacks, we have a menu of really three drugs, or four that makes three classes of drugs: thiazides, calcium channel blockers, and ACE inhibitors, and the angiotensin receptor blockers. In African Americans, although the evidence is not super strong, there's a preference towards thiazides and calcium channel blockers. And in people with chronic kidney disease, we recommend ACE or ARB. Other take-home points: most patients will need two or more drugs to achieve their desired blood pressure goal, so don't fret if one drug isn't enough. I showed you the amounts that the drugs lower blood pressure, roughly about 10 over 5. So if you're a little higher than that when you begin, don't expect to get there all the way with one drug, although non-drug treatment will make the drug work better by in an additive fashion. And control only occurs with motivated patients who trust their clinicians. So this is one of those conditions or illnesses or risk factors, whatever we decide to call it, in which patient engagement and clinician engagement and collaboration together and shared decision-making really make a difference. And then one other key point that hopefully I've emphasized enough, make sure your blood pressure is accurately taken. That's especially true if you're taking it yourself, but you may also have reason to bring it up at your clinician's visit as well. So thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.